Welcome to Cryomo's Tabletop Alchemy. I'm Cryomo, aka Ignatius Fisher, and I'm pretty hyped to say that this is episode 20 of this podcast about my midlife return to all the hobbies I enjoyed a long, long time ago. I'm back into Dungeons & Dragons, I'm back into Warhammer, I'm back into miniature painting and terrain crafting, I'm newly into skirmish games and being an interviewer, and all in all, I'm just happy to be here enjoying the art and creativity of our niche fantasy sci-fi tabletop gaming community. I want to thank all of you out there who are giving the show a chance, and I hope you're all getting goals met and playing new games and enjoying old games and doing your best to survive while being creative. This podcast is intended for all ages, usually, and I'm hoping it provides you with something to listen to while you're hobbying or thinking about hobbying. You can find episodes on most of the big podcast apps. You can watch the YouTube version on, you guessed it, YouTube, where I usually include video of whatever I've been working on at the paint desk. You can find all the episodes and their show notes, as well as links to all of my social media accounts at cryomo.com. And if you're so inclined, you can support me and the show by either becoming a patron at patreon.com or simply leaving a rating or dropping a comment on whatever app you happen to enjoy the show on. All of that is always much appreciated. As always, I give a huge shout out to my patrons. Their support definitely helps keep the show and me going. Any and all support is always much appreciated, you guys. Thank you very much. All right, today there's no interview. I know, just try to hide your disappointment so I can ignore it. All right, this episode, I'm just going to ramble. It's your favorite. I know, trust me. You've been waiting for me to get back to rambling about nonsense ever since I started doing interviews. You don't have to shout at me. I get it. I've heard the fans. Sit down. Take it easy. I got it under control. All right. Yeah, that's mostly facetious. I know the interviews are most popular, and I have plenty of interviews coming up, but sometimes I just want to listen to myself blather on because I'm an egotistical, narcissistic maniac that way. I can't tell you how much I love editing my own voice. Seriously, it's my favorite thing to do, hands down, bar nothing. Me, listening to me, that's what makes my life great. That almost sounded serious, didn't it? All right. Okay, so let me get someone serious and just explain that. While I definitely love doing the interviews and I have no plans to stop with them, and I do have a bunch more already in the can, ready to go, once in a while, I do just kind of want to talk about things I dig or things I've been thinking about, and you know, they sort of build up over time until I've got enough maybe for an episode. So we'll see how this pans out or how this process works. I guess basically what I'm doing today is like just one giant section Charlie for this episode. That's kind of what it is, I suppose. There's still going to be a section Charlie at the end, though. So I'll probably do something like this, episodically speaking, for movies one day, maybe TV shows. I don't know. But today, as per the title of this episode, I'm chatting about books that I dig. In particular, books in the fantasy genre and books that I think are kind of outliers in the whole top 40 bestseller list type of thing. Whatever. These are just books I felt like talking about, and they are books I feel are inspirational to some aspect of tabletop gaming, whether that's world building or character building or location ideas or just ambiance or even ideas for RPG campaigns, maybe even magic systems or rule ideas, all that kind of stuff. All right, so let's jump in. The first author I want to talk about is Frances Hardinge. She's an award-winning British author and has one unique distinction. She's the only author I've ever sent fan mail to. That's right, the only one. And she even replied to my fan mail. That's right, I'm famous by proxy. Hold your applause. There's plenty of time for that at the end. But I digress. Ms. Hardinge, whose last name I'm only hoping I'm pronouncing correctly, is what I call a stupendously, wondrously talented writer. That's a technical term. Let me quote a paragraph from her novel, The Lie Tree. It's a paragraph, the last line of which is one of my favorite lines from, frankly, any book. The setting is Victorian England, all right? All right, here we go. Back in the trophy room, the gentlemen would be taking the leash off their conversation. Likewise, here in the drawing room, each lady quietly relaxed and became more real, expanding into the space left by the men. Without visibly changing, they unfolded like flowers or knives. They unfolded like knives! The setting is a small island town and like an estate type of place in Victorian era England. They unfolded like flowers or knives. So, so good. You can totally see these women with their big dresses and the colors that they're wearing opening up to conversation, but also, you know, they've got all this societal sort of backstabbing ready to go. I don't know. I just thought it's just my favorite line, one of my favorite lines ever. And it's definitely Ms. Hardinge's vocabulary, or rather her writing style, her descriptions and word choice that fully captured my attention when I first encountered one of her books. I don't even remember how I found one of her books. I think I might actually have found it in a library one day while perusing the fantasy section in the kids area while my daughter looked for, you know, picture books to check out. Frances's first novel, because now we're on a first name basis, see? Her first book happened to be the first book I read of hers, and it's called Fly By Night. Now, I recommend anything Frances has written, but my two absolute favorites are Fly By Night and A Face Like Glass. Fly By Night does have a sequel, which I thoroughly enjoyed as well. That one is titled Flytrap in the U.S. and Twilight Robbery in the U.K., I believe. But yeah, Fly By Night is just a really cool book. The main character is a 12-year-old girl called Mosca, and she becomes an orphan in the first couple chapters. The interesting premise in Mosca's sort of medieval Victorian-ish world is that the government is basically outlawing reading and writing. And Mosca's father has been banished for writing inflammatory books about tolerance and freedom. I stole that last bit directly from Frances's website's description of the book. Ms. Hardinge's world building and character building is far out. I could basically do a whole episode just talking about this book, I'm sure. Check out some of these character names. Eponymous Clint, a delightful swindler. Mabwick Toke, the leader of the Guild of Stationers. Quillam Mai, Mosca's father. Mandelion, the capital city. And I forgot to mention Mosca's sidekick, the homicidal goose, Saracen. Saracen. It's awesome. And the goose is pretty dangerous, actually, in the story. Apparently, geese are not to be trifled with. So I'm not the person who should be doing this sort of review. Well, I guess that's why this isn't a review or anything like that. I'm too hindered by my own lack of skill in writing to actually articulate the tremendous skill Ms. Hardinge employs in her story crafting. But the world in this book is fully realized without being a chore to read about. It's like she's sewn in all these sort of second level details beneath the top level character and environment description. So you're constantly learning about the world almost subconsciously just through like her word choice and stuff. You learn about the political factions in the city and the realm. You meet wicked villains who are not stereotypical. You meet heroes that are fun, and there are floating houseboat coffee shops where writers meet. And there's a lady in white who just sort of evokes Alexandre Dumas' Three Musketeers and a villainous group called the Birdcatchers. It's just very, very cool. And all of this is written so young readers can enjoy it, which makes it, you know, easier for me. There's something going on under the surface that I can't possibly elucidate for you because I'm just not smart enough. But there's something about Frances Hardinge being a wonderful writer, writing about a world in which writing is being criminalized, and she's woven writing, air quotes, into the writing of the story itself. One little example is how the table of contents is one of those alphabetical lists for the chapter titles. So each chapter is something like chapter one is A is for arson, chapter two is B is for blackmail, etc. That's just surface level fun, but there's definitely something in the woven structure of the story itself, coupled with the writing, that it just speaks to the joy Frances finds in words and in wordsmithing. All right, the second book I really want to hype is A Face Like Glass. This book features another female protagonist, and of course, Ms. Hardinge's way with words is really one of the greatest reasons to read any of her books, but the world building in A Face Like Glass is phenomenal. I can see all kinds of details being usable in Dungeons & Dragons, campaign writing, or homebrew world building. There's a character called the Kleptomancer, who's like some kind of steampunk Robin Hood. There are face smiths, because in this world, people have to be taught expressions in order to use them, except for the heroine Neverfell. That's the heroine's name, Neverfell. She has to wear a mask all the time because she's inherently expressive all the time, like a normal human. Oh, the subtext is huge. There are cheese masters who craft and create esoteric cheeses that actually produce what is essentially sorcery, magic spell type effects, and they are highly sought after, ostensibly because cheese is difficult to make, and even more so when the cheese is supposed to create some kind of magic. I mean, cheese and magic, come on! How much more fairy tale can you get? The entire setting is underground, and the society is fully stratified, you know, with like classes and ranks and you know, anyway, it's just a fully imagined setting. And again, the characters are particularly drawn and unique, and that's the word, unique. There's a sense of uniqueness here that has enough of a basis in modern fantasy, not modern like urban fantasy, just modern as in like contemporarily produced fantasy fiction. The uniqueness isn't like art house film or anything. It's all very accessible. And again, written for young adults, very digestible. And yet, again, her wordsmithing is so fun to experience. All right, well, check out Frances Hardinge if you get a chance. Of course, links to all this stuff will be in the show notes. And you can find her, of course, at franceshardinge.com. That's F-R-A-N-C-E-S. Hardinge is H-A-R-D-I-N-G-E.com. Let's jump over to another author now, and in particular, one of this author's book series. Nancy Springer is an American author who's written a ton of books. She's probably most famous for, well, I was going to say her Sea King trilogy or the I Am series. I Am Morgan Le Fay. I Am Mordred. I think she did a book that was like about Robin Hood's daughter. But as I just literally found out today, the day I'm writing the script for this episode, she's going to be famous for the series I always thought she should be famous for. And that's because her character, Enola Holmes, is making it to the big screen. It looks like Millie Bobby Brown has been cast as Enola, who is the Nancy Springer-created younger sister of Sherlock Holmes. Helena Bonham Carter is set to play Mother Holmes, and Henry Cavill is Sherlock himself. The Enola Holmes series, I currently believe there are 6 novels, is a mystery series for young adults and older readers with titles like The Case of the Missing Marquess and The Case of the Left-Handed Lady. These are all fully set in straight-up Victorian England. Sherlock is a peripheral character, but has a definitive presence. And in the first book, Enola is 14 years old, and her mother vanishes, but it seems that she has left of her own accord and has abandoned Enola to an empty house and the sort of overbearing oversight of her 2 much older brothers. Ms. Springer covers all kinds of thematic territory in these books, but at the fore is always the mystery and the adventure of a young woman trying to get ahead in a very patriarchal society. These books are just super fun. If you're at all interested in the classic whodunit-style mysteries or kid adventures like The Goonies and, well, I mean, these aren't horror stories like Stranger Things, but if you dig the Victorian era, and of course if you like Sherlock, you'll probably dig these books. I've recommended them numerous times, and they're also fantastic for young adult readers. I'd say easily in the range of 12 to 16 years old. Enola is very clever. Nancy writes quick, evocative description in a constantly moving narrative. The books are never slow. The payoffs are great, and really they are all about the character of Enola herself, and she's a fantastic, strong female character to be able to look up to. I love these books now, and I would have loved them when I was 12 or 13. They would have been one of those book series that I would have stayed up with a flashlight under the bedsheets to finish reading. Anyone younger than me probably won't know these titles, but I was a huge fan of The Three Investigators when I was a kid, and Enola Holmes would fit right on the shelf with those. Well, I'm sure you'll hear more about this character now that a studio adaptation is being produced, so keep an eye out for the trailers and spoilers and all that stuff. And sort of as an afterthought, in thinking about what the books entail, I think this movie has a genuine chance of being a decent adaptation. The books are not overly long, nor overly complicated. Okay, you know, who knows? I'm sure the books will probably be better than the adaptation as per usual, but there's a chance we could get a good movie-going experience out of the deal. We'll see. Actually, now that I've looked up the director, I mean, who knows? This is his first feature, but he's done a ton of television. I don't know how to make a guess on that. My initial instinct is to be, you know, trepidatious, but, you know, whatever. Here's to hoping it's going to be fun. All right, moving on. Let's talk about graphic novels. That's right. One of the greatest stories I've ever had the pleasure of reading, of experiencing, and not only reading, but basically performing for my daughter when she was probably 6 or 7, for my oldest, Katerina. I did all the characters with specific voices for the entire 9-volume graphic novel series called Bone by Jeff Smith. And I actually got to shake Mr. Smith's hand at San Diego Comic-Con 1 year, and you can too. He's always attending comic book conventions, and yes, he's super cool, and as far as I know, Bone is probably his most successful work. He both illustrated and wrote the comics, which indeed debuted as individual comic book issues before being collected into the graphic novel format. Kira even gave me the hardback omnibus for my birthday, which I haven't read yet to her chagrin, but it weighs about 25 pounds and it's the colorized version. I say colorized because the original graphic novels and comics were entirely black and white and they got a color treatment, which is actually really nicely done, but they got that colorization much later after publication. So Bone is pretty much a work of genius. On the surface, when you initially look at it, it seems like it shouldn't work because you have these three main characters who are, I guess, of a race called Bones, and the main character is called Phone Bone, that's with an F. His shiesty cousin is called Phony Bone, and his doofus cousin is called Smiley Bone, and they're all drawn in a super specific cartoon style, like Casper the Ghost or something like that. But everything else in Bone, the world, all the other characters, except maybe for the dragon, he's oddly cartoony as well, all the other characters are much more realistic, like they are all definitively medieval type humans. The rat creatures are kind of like hairy orcs or goblins with sharp fangs, and the Bones are weird cartoon guys. It's almost like it's got a bit of a Roger Rabbit sort of feel, but somehow, some way, it all just works. It just flat out works, and it works really well. The Bones are specifically lost and trying to find their way home when they get caught up in this huge Lord of the Rings style Dungeons and Dragons type of story where they have to help out some folks and they share screen time with other heroes that are actually mightier than they are, but they support and help them as friends, and they face crazy odds together and monsters and prophecies and evil mages and societies, and it's just this really well done adventure story. But what makes it super fantastic, of course, are the characters. The characters are literally so well drawn, they are captivating. I mean, I was able to do about 10 to 20 unique voices based on what the characters looked and sounded like in their dialogue, and I never ever got lost or forgot what a character sounded like. I mean, because, you know, when I'd sit down to read a bedtime story to Katarina when she's little, and we would probably read, you know, one issue, one chapter, you know, like one graphic novel probably contains six of the comic book issues, so each chapter would be one issue, which is about 22 pages. You know, we'd read those in sections. It took us a while to get through the whole storyline. And I never got lost or forgot what a character sounded like. I'll always remember when I first did the hissing voice for the main villain. My daughter freaked out and really did not want me to do that voice. She was terrified. But I did it anyway, and I'm sure it scarred her for life. And yes, I'm sorry I did that. So, you know, warning to you parents out there, when you see the black word balloons with the inverted white text that's all wavy and just sort of makes you automatically hear a hissing sibilance in your head, keep it to yourself, unless your kiddo is like, you know, 10 or something. Of course, they'll probably be reading it themselves at that point. Anyway, Bone is just a fantastic, family-friendly, but still edge-of-your-seat fantasy action adventure with true bits of comic relief and true bits of tragedy and thematic commentary on growing up and accepting responsibility and loving life and being part of a society. I cannot recommend it enough. If the black and white original throws you off, the colorized version is equally gorgeous, and Jeff Smith's fantastic ability to evoke emotions and action and movement and ambiance with his inked pen strokes and his pitch-perfect characterization of dialogue, this story is just a joy to read. Really, it is. All right, last book I want to recommend is not for kids. The British author Joe Abercrombie has written probably around 9 novels, maybe more. All of them, I believe, are set in the same world. He writes what some people call grimdark, and I suppose the world setting is low fantasy, which implies, to me anyway, that magic is not a prevalent detail. In fact, in most of the books, magic either doesn't really appear, or if it does, it's usually only wielded by a single individual, and or it's very mysterious. So first off, let's talk about saving the world. This is by far my own most personally disliked story trope, which means that I dislike almost all generic fantasy fiction. I'm just tired of it. I really am tired of the Child of Prophecy, the Save the World from Imminent Destruction, all of this sort of big tier, top level, James Bond 007 saves the life of every man, woman, and child on the planet nonsense. I only really enjoyed the first half of the first movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. As soon as our characters get lost in giant piles of huge armies, I just sort of tune out. I've always said for the longest time that I want to see Tarantino do fantasy. I want to see Reservoir Dogs in D&D. And Joe Abercrombie suddenly appeared with what essentially is the same viewpoint. As a writer, he's like Tarantino meets George R.R. Martin meets Sergio Leone, and they all had a creative brainchild. All right, that's probably a little much, but you get the picture. I highly recommend all of his books, of course. I think his first trilogy is completely badass and awesome to read. It's called the First Law Trilogy. It consists of the titles The Blade Itself, Before They Are Hanged, and Last Argument of Kings. Damn it, I'm looking at his newly revamped website right now to get some information, and he's just released the first book of his new trilogy. Oh, hang on. I'll be right back. I gotta go buy it on iBooks real quick. Hang on. Okay, $14. I just downloaded the sample. I'll buy it in a few days. I'm trying to pace myself. But oh man, the inside cover art is a helm with a wolf crest, and under the helm are a bunch of clockwork gears. Abercrombie's doing steampunk or something. Holy moly, I can't wait. I love this guy's stuff. All right, back to the topic at hand. My current two favorite books of his, even though I like all of them, don't get me wrong, read them all, but my favorite is Best Served Cold. This book is so good that even though I have no hope in really any world of ever being able to afford, or not to mention being capable of making, I've checked almost every year to see if the film rights are available to option. Spoiler, no, they are not. That does not mean a movie will get made. It just means somebody is sitting on the rights. To be perfectly honest, I don't think Best Served Cold can be a single movie, but it probably couldn't be a trilogy either. Two movies would work, and probably an 8-episode like HBO miniseries would actually be the best format. Best Served Cold is basically Kill Bill meets Game of Thrones, directed by, let's be specific, early Guy Ritchie. Or maybe, you know, directed by Tarantino or Sam Peckinpah, someone like that. My second current favorite novel of Joe's is Red Country, and Red Country is almost a 100% straight up spaghetti western where the world is just on the cusp of the invention of gunpowder. So there are no guns or anything. People still carry swords and spears and shields and whatever, but it's all about a wagon train cutting across a new frontier and mercenaries and slavers and dust and gambling Wild West towns with warring saloon factions. It's freaking awesome. But back to Best Served Cold. This is an ensemble piece, and the lead character, who is a hardcore swordswoman slash strategist, her name is Monza Mercado, and she's the Duke of Orso's most feared and famous mercenary captain. And at the beginning of the book, slight spoiler here, but not really, because it's literally the first chapter, she is murdered by her employer. Well, attempted murdered. I don't know how to say this. All right. Some bad dudes try to kill her. Some very powerful bad people attempt to kill her. They think they've succeeded, and she barely survives, and she swears revenge on everyone who was in the room when it happened. Once she recuperates, and one of her sword hand is actually crushed, so she can't actually even fight with her sword anymore, the thing that made her like badass to begin with. It's just so awesome. She goes about assembling a group of some of the most fun and depraved, murderous outlaws that she can find, and systematically goes through her list. Of course, nothing ever really goes as planned, but the story is brutal, the action is insanely well-paced, and even as she hunts down the men responsible for this attempt on her life and the death of her brother, she is hunted in turn by one of the coolest assassins in my book, since Artemis Entreri. Check this quote out from the website. Her allies include Styria's least reliable drunkard, Styria's most treacherous poisoner, a mass murderer obsessed with numbers, and a barbarian killer who just wants to do the right thing. Springtime in Styria means revenge. It's so, so good. It's just awesome. The poisoner, Castor Morvir, and his creepily ditzy assistant, Day, this cute little blonde girl, they're two of the funniest and craziest characters I've ever read. And I don't mean funny like slapstick. I mean grimdark funny like, oh, where did I put that antidote? I swear I put it in this pocket, or maybe this pocket. Or, Day, do you have the antidote? He's about to die. That kind of funny. The first target this crew goes after results in a scenario that unfolds with some cat burglary, reverse heist awesomeness. I have a particular fondness for cat burglars, the whole genre type thing. I don't know why. And this, but there's also, and then there's also this huge accident that results in I can't really say anything because it's all spoilers. Let's just say that the outcome of their first scenario is particularly dark and super unexpected, very creative, and very funny. Funny to me, anyway. But the characters are all very different from each other. I feel Joe's writing of his lead character, Monza, is incredibly nuanced. I think all of his his ability to write characters is really his strength. And it's just, all in all, his books are just awesome because of it. All of his characters sort of reappear in the background of other books here and there. There's definitely a cohesion to his world that is very well done. There's some magic here that would make for some great D&D style gimmicks, and just some scenarios that would make for the most stupendously cool D&D movie ever seen. I really wish I could make it. All right, so I got through these recommendations. I was kind of going through in my head about what I'm currently reading and what I've got on my radar at the moment. I'm eagerly awaiting William Gibson's new novel, but I'm not sure when that will release. The drop dates keep changing, but it's a sequel to his last one, The Peripheral. Those are sci-fi books, so I'm not going to talk about my love of all things Gibson right now. That's for the sci-fi podcast, except I don't read too much sci-fi. I like cyberpunk and sort of near future. That's more my jam on that front. But anyway, speaking of sci-fi, I interviewed recently an Australian miniature painter who currently produces Warhammer 40K dioramas. He's on Instagram, and he's known as The Real Broken Fingers. And his interview is not out yet. It'll drop in a few weeks. But some things he said about the Black Library, that's the Games Workshop stable of literature, all of it describing their 40K and fantasy universe. He said some things that made me seek out a couple of specific authors, and I ended up purchasing one of their books to read. My first ever 40K novel. It's called Black Legion, and it's written by Aaron Dembski Bowden. It's interesting, and I've been doing some additional research into the wikis online about the whole 40K lore, and it's as wild and far-reaching and random as you might think it would be, but the writing of this particular book definitely evokes the whole Games Workshop pseudo-religious gothic grimdark vibe, and yeah, I'm finding it kind of interesting, at least this particular book. I've read samples from a smattering of the Black Library, and to be perfectly honest, none of the writing has really hit me as particularly great. Don't be offended. I'm notorious for being super difficult to please and liking only what I like. There is an astonishing amount of lore out there, however, and I find that pretty fascinating, more so because of the volume of it and like what it is, more so than like the content itself. I don't know. There's one thing that bothers me about the whole 40K universe, or setting as a story setting. And it's the thing that has always made me shy away from even bothering with the Black Library stuff. And this is going to for sure give away my own stupid short-sightedness and lack of understanding of what's out there. But the whole concept of the 40K universe, in fact, the tagline for the whole thing, there is only war. So all the fluff talks about all this war, all this destruction. Progress is virtually impossible due to the massive scale of tyranny and death running rampant throughout the galaxy. And all I do is wonder, where are the actual people? Like, where is the everyday guy, like me, hanging out? Like, if my only options are to fight in an army for eternity, or be a slave to some hellish, like, warp-spawned chaos god, I don't think I want to stick around. So the whole universe has seemed inaccessible to me as a reader, as an audience member for the telling of stories. I mean, I get that crazy badass things can happen in war, but if the result of all that warfare is only more war, I don't know, man. It just doesn't sound fun. I don't understand why I want to read that. I guess. I don't know. Anyway, all right. But that said, I'm giving this book Black Legion a shot. It's interesting from a sort of, let me see where this goes sort of viewpoint, and I'll stick it out, see how it develops and wraps up. I will say that the reason I bought it was I was intrigued by the opening scene and the main character, who is a psyker, which is basically a mage or a wizard in the 40K universe. And he's the lead military commander's assassin for his legion that he's in, right? His army. So I thought that was cool. A sci-fi mage assassin who infiltrates mines and has a demon cougar thing as a familiar. Yeah, it's kind of cool. So I'm into it. All right. So that's it for my books. I dig it bit. How about some hobby progress? All right. This week I got three figures painted and three figures primed for next week. I can't imagine I'll finish three figures a week. That's insane, but it sounds good. I finished up those three backstabbing goblin assassins, the Warhammer Nasty Skulkers. I got through them relatively quickly, and while they are not the best, they are totally decent tabletop quality, which is what I always go for. I realized after photographing them for Instagram that I am probably never going to achieve anything above tabletop standard because, one, I simply don't like to spend too much time on any one model, but more importantly, two, I can't physically see good enough to get blends and layering that work on a micro scale, which the camera can see. And of course, that's not necessary at all when it comes to tabletop gaming, but I do see things a lot differently when I see the macro shot big on my computer, or even just small on my phone, than when I see them when I'm actually painting. But that's fine. I don't mind. I'm just having a good time getting stuff done. And as I said last week, those characters are, they're just cool little goblin guys. I really had fun painting them. They didn't have too much extra detail on them, which made them fun to get, you know, quicker to get through. And I enjoyed them. And I like the bases that I put them on, stuff like that. So I thought they were pretty cool. Check them out on Instagram if you get a chance. And then what did I get primed for next week? I asked Kira to choose a figure for me to paint from my online gallery of minis to paint. And she chose a female monk from the Bushido game. Literally the only figure I own from that game. It's a fantastic little model, and I will never be able to do her justice, but I'll do my best. I got her mounted on a cool base that's sort of rosebush themed, and she looks pretty awesome on it. I also built and primed up one of the scout troopers on the speeder bike from Star Wars Legion. That's going to be fun. And I primed up the only Dragonkin figure I own. I literally just reached into one of my boxes. I just have the cardboard boxes that are just full of like Reaper miniatures, you know, blister packs and stuff. And I thought, let me just pull one out and see what it is. I pulled it out. It was a Dragonkin, and he's the only Dragonkin figure that I own. I figure I better paint up a Dragonkin because, you know, if I want to get a D&D game going, then a group is likely going to have some player that wants to play a Dragonkin. Anyway, he is, he's like a mage or a wizard or a warlock type. He's from Reaper Minis. He looks pretty cool. I think he'll look pretty awesome. I mean, he can't double really as a fighter, but you know, he could in a pinch, but he looks like it'll be fun. It's a lot of flowing cloak kind of stuff and ripply muscle, flesh, skin tones. I don't know. Anyway, he looks pretty good. So I'm looking forward to these three. I am afraid of painting the smaller details. Yes, both on the Bushido and the Reaper miniatures, but I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to dive in, splash some paint, drown them in washes and move on. That's right. I also got in the mail one more figure from Star Wars Legion. Sigh. Yes, I bought the Jyn Erso miniature. I just thought that the sculpt looked so cool. I wanted to paint her up. I mean, I don't know why that miniature appealed to me. I still have no desire to play that Star Wars game. Some of the Rebel Commandos do look pretty fun to paint. But anyway, the Jyn Erso looked cool, and I thought, yeah, I'll have fun painting her up. And maybe, I don't know what game I'd use her in. I have no idea. Anyway, all right, Beastgrave is currently tempting me. I'm thinking about doing another section within Hobby Progress. That's called Current Temptations, I guess. I don't know. But Beastgrave is currently tempting me, and I'm fighting that off. Also, there are three figures in my shopping cart on RelicBlade.com that I'm doing my best not to purchase. But man, they're so cool. Okay, let's go to Section Charlie. Right, Section Charlie, where I highlight someone or something I found on the internet that I think is cool and worth saying loudly that I like. So this episode, I'm going to shout out the very cool Instagram account called Dungeon Mapster. Now, as luck would have it, I literally just scheduled a day to interview this gentleman about his fantasy RPG map-making chops and Dungeons & Dragons in general, as it appears that he is also a Dungeon Master as well as a Dungeon Mapster. But seriously, check out this guy's art on his Instagram, and then you can link over to his Patreon and even purchase some of that incredibly cool art for yourself. And his Patreon is insanely cheap, too. $1 or $2 gets you either a high-resolution map or a full PSD file of those maps. To be honest, the real selling point of those PSD files are the words "well-organized" preceding the words PSD files that he's got on his Patreon. That is super cool. On his Instagram, you'll see that he does full maps of various scenes. His artwork is beautiful in a sort of storybook or comic book style, and he does both gridded and ungridded maps, all kinds of terrain, full villages and cities and dungeons, and he even releases build your own kits where you get a bunch of assets or map tokens like individual structures, towers, ground debris, etc., that have transparency, so you can create and decorate your own maps. His stuff is great. I can't wait to chat with him about his art and about playing D&D. And as always, visit crymo.com for the show notes, where you'll find links to Dungeon Mapster and all the books and authors I rambled about. And drop me a note, either through one of my social media outlets or a direct email to crymo@gmail.com with any fantasy book recommendations you might have for me. All right, that spits a grapefruit seed in this eye. I hope everyone out there has a wonderful week. I hope you get some gaming in. I hope you get some reading in. I hope you get some just plain old-fashioned having fun in. I'm Crying Mo. You're you. This world is what we imagine it to be. So go on, imagine something far out. And I will see ya.